For the first part of the lecture, I kind of want to finish one topic that I didn't get to yet, which was basically how to define a black hole in dynamical settings, in particular the concept of an apparent horizon and how it contrasts with an event horizon. We'll discuss that. And then for the last part of the lecture, I just want to give you sort of a very shallow but and brief overview of some of the topics people are thinking about in strong gravity. So yeah, and if you have any questions or things you want to discuss about that, go wherever you're interested. Okay, so to begin with, let's talk about apparent horizons. Yeah, so you know, in class we sort of talked about how we wanted to go beyond just considering stationary spacetimes and actually, you know, think about the Einstein equations as evolution equations where you specify some initial data, you know, you have nonlinear dynamics, black holes merge, things like that. In order to do that, you know, we need to sort of have a definition of black holes that sort of is suited to dynamical settings. So to begin with, let's just review the definition of or the black hole horizon concept that we've discussed before, which is an event horizon. So an event horizon, we define this as the boundary of the causal past of future null infinity. So black hole is you take your manifold, you look at the causal past of future null infinity, also called scribe plus, and then the event horizon is just the boundary of that black hole. So to sort of draw a picture in a dynamical setting, so let's imagine that we have some collapsing matter. And it, you know, collapses into a dense enough region that you form a black hole. So this future null infinity, scribe plus, basically look at its causal past. Remember that null rays are at 45 degrees here. And so this is the event horizon. So all, you know, any light rays here can propagate to infinity. Any ones here have to stay inside the event horizon. That's an event horizon. But there are a couple of features of this event horizon that might sort of give you pause that it's completely well suited to dynamical settings, especially when you're considering, you know, evolving things in time. And you might not, you know, start with the whole solution. You're actually constructing the solution sort of one time slice at a time. So
had in these kind of diagrams is when we have assume r is equal to constant surfaces in this Penrose diagram are the lines that you drew from top to bottom, right? R is equal to constant surfaces are just getting more denser and denser towards boundary, but it's the same the world line of the star, like you have that world line of the star you have drawn is r is equal to constant surface, right?
So this is, yeah, it's a little bit confusing because if you have like a r equals constant, it will get kind of more compactified here. But this is supposed to be the Kendra more extreme. So this is the collapsing. This is a collapsing star.
I think just the ideal constant surfaces look like that. But then suddenly we say that the event horizon looks like this. But event horizon, in my mind, the picture, the way horizon we defined was R equal to constant null surface. So in this case, that line of event horizon does not look like R equal to constant surface, right?
Yeah, you're talking about in Schwarzschild coordinate.
Yeah.
So there. Yes, I mean, so the rule here is null lines are 45 degrees, and if it's more horizontal, it's space-like, and it's more vertical, it's time-like. And for Schwarzschild coordinates, the R coordinate actually, for large R, it's like a space-like coordinate, but it becomes null at R equals 2m, right? And then it switches and becomes.
Yeah, I see. Yeah. Probably it becomes that.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so the first feature of the event horizon is that you can notice that it requires knowledge of our whole space-time bar. Right, according to this definition, you have to sort of know the whole kind of future history of which light rays escape and which ones don't. It's not sort of a locally defined quantity. And sort of a related feature here is that it's teleological, which means that it sort of anticipates the future. Right, so let's imagine you have some, say it's a thin shell of matter. It starts at some very large radius, it's not compact at all, and then it just starts collapsing inward. Roughly if it's kind of infinitely thin, you have like a Schwarzschild solution outside the shell of matter, and you'll have a flat space solution inside the matter, right?
Yeah.
And then as it collapses in, once it crosses its Schwarzschild radius at R equals 2m, then you'll have this surface where, outside you'll have like a Schwarzschild type solution. But sort of the event horizon will actually occur before the matter crosses its Schwarzschild radius. You can think of, for example, right? So let's just imagine that this is kind of a thin shell of matter here. So, on this time slice, you already have an event horizon, right? And even though this is completely flat space here, right? So what happens is, you try to shoot a beam of light here, it's fine, it'll still keep going outwards. But then as you evolve the future in time, then eventually this shell of matter comes and hits it. It can no longer escape here, right? So that's this kind of teleological aspect of the event horizon, is that already here, this part is inside the event horizon, because the event horizon knows that this shell of matter at some later time is going to come collapse on it. So any questions about that?
So maybe clarifying this, that we know that a collapsing star is finally going to, if according to this picture, is going to produce an event horizon. But then you are saying that at a time slice where the star has not gone inside its Schwarzschild radius, even at that location we have an event horizon. Even at that time we have an event horizon, which is like anticipating that the star may collapse.
Yeah, exactly. It's the light rays that are at the center of the star. They can start to move outward initially, but they'll never make it outside the black hole before it forms.
I see. Strange.
Yeah.
I've heard Penrose discussing this, the upper and the horizons and the trapped surfaces and all these things when he was considering the gravitational collapse. And
yeah.
I was puzzled with this thing that he was saying that one of the horizons, and I guess it was the upper and the horizon, senses that the star will collapse and move southward somehow, and then something like, I don't know if this rings a bell. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
is this the picture that you're trying to describe here? Something.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so the apparent the event horizon, yeah, like we just said, knows that the star is going to collapse, so it kind of, in that sense, moves outwards that way, right?
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
If you have a shrinking universe, does the event horizon move out?
A shrinking, like a collapsing universe. Right. Well, so there it's a little bit tricky to apply this definition because you don't have this asymptotically flat region, right? So in that sense, you can apply the concepts of like apparent horizons in these marginally trapped surfaces to like collapsing homogeneous universes. But it's hard to apply these like global ones here, right? Because like, you know, if you have a crunching universe, it's gonna end in a big crunch or something, right? You don't have this concept of things that escape and things that don't. Right, so to kind of address some of these things, we're going to introduce sort of a more local definition of a black hole horizon called an apparent horizon. And to do that, we first need to introduce a couple of other concepts. So let's imagine we have some time slice we'll call sigma t. And then we're going to choose a two-dimensional space-like surface, a closed one in particular. That's at this time, what's in sigma t. And let's say it has a induced metric, we call that QAB, and L is a normal. Okay, so the idea is we have some two-dimensional spatial surface S. The metric that lives on S is QAB, and then we have a normal vector field on S we'll call L. All right, so then we can define the expansion. I'll call this curly O to be the lead derivative with respect to L of the logarithm of the square root of the determinant of the induced metric Q. And that can also be written just as this. So this is basically the, think of this as the fractional change in area of the surface S and the direction of L. Yeah.
So QAB is the induced metric on S.
Yeah.
So root S would be like infinitesimal area. Root Q would be like an infinitesimal area.
Yeah, it's just the determinant of this metric. Yeah, that's the it's the area element on S.
So this is how the area element is changing with along the normal.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so we're going to take L to be a null vector. And we can sort of define an outward and inward null vector the following way. We'll call them plus and minus. So here, NA is the unit normal to our slices of constant time. And then SA here is the space-like unit normal to S. Right, so we're constructing a null vector by adding a unit time like one and a unit space like one, right? So plus just takes you forward in time and outward away from S, and then L minus is forward in time and then inward in the space like direction.
Maybe I'm not clear with how S is defined. L is the normal to the surface, and we are saying if we want L to be null, you can write it as N plus minus S.
Yeah, so NA is just take a slice of constant time and then take the gradient of that, and that will give you a normal vector. So then once we've restricted to the slice of constant time, then we can take this the level surface of S and then take a gradient of that level function, and that'll give us a vector that lives in sigma t that's also normal to S.
But that should give us just the L directly, right? It should give the normal to S.
So this will give us a normal, this will give us a space like normal to S, right? Think of this as just you say at some constant time, you have a sphere, and then the unit normal will just be the, in the radial direction or something like that, right? So that's not a null vector, that's just a space-like vector. So to construct a null vector, we have to have one that both moves in that direction of space and then also moves in time.
I see. So then now I'm confused, because earlier we had defined L to be that normal vector, right? Which is normal to S. Or L is not normal to S. In the when we defined our surface S, which has reduced metric Q, and we said L is our normal field to Q.
Yeah, so.
Oh, you're saying this L could be in both time and space.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
So once we restrict to the fixed time,
then you get.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but then we're also allowing it to move off the sigma t. So you can think of an example, if you have just the sphere sitting there in Minkowski space, then it would be a light ray that goes in the radial direction. So it's going in radially in space, but in time, it's also moving outward in time.
So L is a normal vector field to S, and then N is the time-like vector. Vector field that is
it's just the unit normal to this.
The other vector is the space-like normal to the two-dimensional surface, which is a space-like vector. Okay.
Yeah, and then in particular, we're choosing the usual normalizations. That this normalizes to minus one, the unit normal to slices of constant time. Our space-like one, space-like unit vector, so that's one, and then what that means is that combination is zero, and yeah, because it's a null vector. So if you contract it with itself, it's zero. But then we take the plus minus, then we get minus two. All right, so now we can define the outward null expansion. Which is just basically this guy for L plus. And if you work out what that is in the 3 plus 1 decomposition, you get the following. So this is the divergence of our unit normal. This is the extrinsic curvature contracted with the unit normals, and that's the trace of the extrinsic curvature. Okay, so if this quantity, the outward null expansion, is less than or equal to zero everywhere, on S, then we call S an outer trap surface. And if it's equal to zero, then we call that marginally outer trap surface. And then we're going to call the outermost marginally outer trap surface. So here, outermost just means it's not contained within another marginally outer trap surface. We're going to call that the apparent horizon. So this outermost here just means it's not nested within another marginally outer trap surface. Yeah, so it's in that sense, it's a little, it's kind of quasi-local. So yeah, I should also note that this definition of apparent horizon actually differs slightly from the one that Hawking originally used. So there, that was defined as basically the boundary of a trapped region. So you have some region where any point within that region is contained on a trapped surface, and then you extend it as far as possible, and then the boundary of that trapped region, what Hawking called the apparent horizon. This requirement, that the surface be marginally outer trapped, kind of generic, but some different authors will kind of also require additional things. For example, you know, another, sometimes people require that the, if you look at the inward null expansion, that be negative. That's part of the definition of a dynamical horizon, that the any slice of it satisfy this one and this one. But sort of for most physically interesting situations, basically what you think of the black hole horizon basically satisfies all these requirements. So they're kind of give you the same thing. Is there a question?
think so. I haven't formulated it.
Okay.
What is the picture here? Do we have the apparent horizon as the outermost trapped surface, and then as we evolve the system, we go to the preview, the nested horizons until we reach at the event horizon or something like this? What is the intuition that this is the outermost?
So here, outermost just means, yeah, so we'll give you an example in just a second on a binary black hole merger, where you'd have one of these like marginally outer trapped surfaces that would be contained within another one. So maybe that'll help. But yeah, so like, yeah.
Sorry. Do you need to violate the null energy condition for the apparent horizon to be outside of the event horizon?
Yeah. So I was gonna.
Sorry.
It's fine. Yeah. So you're kind of anticipating, but basically, what Hawking showed is that if you have an apparent horizon, then you know, assuming cosmic censorship and energy conditions, this apparent horizon will always be inside an event horizon.
Oh.
So you can think of like in a dynamical situation, say you have a black hole that's growing or something like that, then the apparent horizon will be, you have some situation where the apparent horizon will go like this, and it'll asymptote to be null, whereas the event horizon is always null. So once things settle down, the two are the same. So, you know, for example, the Schwarzschild occur, but you think the event horizon is the apparent horizon. So sort of the intuition here is, at your apparent horizon, you can, you know, take a flashlight, take some light. You try to, if you point inward to the surface, that so if you think of kind of shining light everywhere on the surface, that light is going to decrease in area. And then if you try to shine it outward, the area of that kind of that light is also going to decrease, because it's going to be forced to fall into the black hole. So it's, you know, this is a kind of locally defined quantity, in the sense that you can kind of think of, you know, it's whether or not this expansion of the null rays is positive or negative. But we should note that, you know, the way I defined it here, I did refer to a particular time slicing. So to define that, you have to, you know, choose a time slicing. And so it is possible to construct some, you know, pathological examples of sort of bad time slices where you have no apparent horizon, even for example, for like Schwarzschild. So it is important to note that the apparent horizon is a sort of slice dependent concept. Yeah, so maybe to address the other question, talk about what happens in like a binary black hole merger. So in a binary black hole merger, if you look at the event horizons, then you'll have what's something is called this pair of pants diagram, where have the individual black holes, and then they'll eventually merge, and then you have, once they merge, so this is what the event horizon looks sort of going forward in time, right? Two individual black holes, they merge here, right? So we can ask what happens for the apparent horizon. So in apparent horizon, so sometime before the black holes merge, we have two apparent horizons. Corresponding to the individual black holes. This is before they merge, and then sort of once they get close enough to each other, you'll still have these marginally outer trapped surfaces. But you'll find another marginally outer trapped surface that contains both of them. And so this is when this outermost comes in, right?
Sorry, what is TCM?
So I'm just saying that's TCH. This is a common horizon.
Oh.
I'm saying before a common horizon forms, or let's say right before it forms, we have these two black holes that are close to each other, and so we have two apparent horizons. And then right at the time when the common horizon forms, you still have these marginally outer trapped surfaces, so they didn't disappear, but you have this new marginally outer trapped surface that just appears at this time. And so now by this outermost marginally outer trapped surface definition, this is the apparent horizon, and these are not. So that's different from this event horizon here, where there is a kind of continuous evolution from the two to the one. Yeah, and as also just mentioned, if you have any trapped surface, it's going to be contained within the event horizon, assuming cosmic censorship and energy conditions, in particular the null energy condition. And then as you settle down to a stationary solution, this apparent horizon will approach the event horizon. And they are the same for stationary spacetimes.
So if you excise the apparent horizon and you're violating the null energy condition, are you maybe doing something bad with causality?
Right. So I mean, I guess the at the apparent horizon, things are, the characteristics are locally ingoing, so it should be fine there at that time. But if you don't sort of assume cosmic censorship, then yeah, you basically don't have any guarantee that in the future you won't need that information that you're excising at some later time. So yeah, I mean, I think the cosmic censorship assumption here, or sorry, the null energy. Yeah. But yeah. Or does that answer your question? Or. Okay. Any other questions about event horizons or apparent horizons?
So finally, in the black holes like Schwarzschild and Kerr, the event horizon is the same as the apparent horizon, which is also a killing horizon. Everything coincides, but
yeah.
There could be situations where all of these three things would be different. Something.
Yeah.
I think that theorems refer to the trapped surface, right? Which is the point of no return, so the singularity will fall.
So you're talking about like cosmic censorship or something? Or?
No, this is a conjecture. I'm talking about the singularity theorems. That the prediction that singularity will fall in gravitational collapse or something. I think they're referring to the trapped surface, right?
I mean, I think you can show that, if you have these trapped surfaces, then eventually you have to have some breakdown, right? You can't have a geodesically complete spacetime, yeah. Yeah, and that sort of follows from having a shop surface.
This guy tend to the sparsely horizon from the inside, right? Because it's included in the event horizon, the drop surface.
Yeah. So basically, as soon as you go inside the apparent horizon, you'll have trap surfaces. And the apparent horizon is always inside the event horizon. Any other questions? Yeah, so in the last sort of half hour, just want to briefly mention. That's stuck.
This might not work.
All right, we'll switch to the other board. So in the last part of the class, I just want to briefly mention sort of some of the topics that people think about in strong gravity. Definitely can't get to everything. All right. So, certainly the kind of most exciting thing that's been, happening in the past few years has been the detection of gravitational waves, right? By, LIGO, Virgo. So, first I want to just kind of briefly talk about, what the gravitational wave sources that these detectors have been seeing, which are compact object mergers. So I'll just briefly mention the different types of compact object mergers and how you sort of theoretically understand them and come up with predictions that you can compare to the data and actually use the optimally search the data for these signals. So when people say compact object mergers, they usually mean black holes and neutron stars. And you can get mergers of kind of all the combinations of these two things. So two black holes merging, two neutron stars merging, or a black hole merging with a neutron star. So maybe the first one to mention is binary black hole mergers. We think we have a complete theory of it sort of exactly describes, what happens in one of these mergers, solving the vacuum Einstein equations, right? So the way, have exactly the equations we need in practice, solving them is hard because there are these, complicated coupled nonlinear PDEs. So in order to sort of make predictions, you can compare to the data, and so you can also search for these signals. There's sort of a whole number of different techniques that people combine to sort of come up with the most accurate predictions. But if you look at the sort of waveform for one of these systems, you start off having sort of quasi-circular in spiral. We have the two black holes circling each other in a quasi-circular orbit, and the frequency sort of slowly increasing. And the separation is decreasing. And then finally, they'll get close enough where things kind of go nonlinear. And two black holes are getting close, and you get this, we just drew over there, like a common horizon. And then you get this quasi-normal ringing, which I think you guys talked about at the beginning of the week. You can sort of roughly divide this sort of orbiting and merging of these black holes into three different sort of epochs. So one would be the in-spiral phase, one would be the merger phase, and then one would be the ring down phase. And of course, the boundary between these things is a little bit fuzzy. But roughly, you can think of these three different parts of the waveform as better suited to different sort of techniques to understand them. So in the in-spiral regime, there's been sort of a huge effort to use perturbation theory, in particular post-Newtonian formalism, come up with predictions for what happens in this in-spiral part. So that's doing an expansion and basically the velocity over the speed of light. We'll talk about that in a second. Eventually this is going to break down because the black holes will be moving near the speed of light of strong field dynamics. So for this merger part of the waveform, the ideal way to do that is using numerical relativity. So that's basically using simulations to numerically solve the field equations. And we'll talk a little bit about that. And then finally, there's the ring down. And sort of once the perturbation to the black hole is sufficiently small, you can use black hole perturbation theory, as you all discussed at the beginning of the week. All right. So post-Newtonian, the kind of 2-minute summary. Is that you're doing an expansion in powers of the velocity compared to the speed of light, or in the gravitational potential compared to the separation. So from the Virial theorem, we know that these are basically going to be comparable. And so we call this small parameter epsilon. Then you often hear this term that is like 2.5 post-Newtonian expression or something like that. So that means that that you're expanding to that order in epsilon. And I should note that recently people have also been interested in using methods, for example, from computing amplitudes in higher energy physics to actually do what's called a post-Minkowskian. So instead of post-Newtonian, it's the post-Minkowskian expansion. So in that case, you're still expanding in powers of GM over R, but you're not assuming that the velocity is much smaller than the speed of light. So for like a quasi-circle in-spiral, you do expect those terms to be roughly at the same order, but I guess there are some advantages in keeping the V over C terms. Okay, so just to give you some flavor of that, so here's, for example, you think of this is the derivative of the velocity with respect to time, the acceleration. And we have our Newtonian piece. And then we basically have terms in this Pn expansion. That we want to compute using perturbation theory. So just to give you a flavor, here's the leading order first post-Newtonian expression. Here is the symmetric mass ratio. So it's we have a binary M1 and M2. That's that. So this is the this is the just leading order correction. This is actually the one you need to calculate the the periastron advance in an eccentric orbit. But if you think this is complicated, you should see the fourth post-Newtonian expression, which starts to become pages and pages long. And so the radiation reaction, the gravitational waves actually enters at 2.5 pn in this expansion. So if you include those terms. So I think actually in the tutorial you calculated the amount of gravitational radiation that would be emitted for a binary undergoing a circular orbit, right? If you take that energy out of the orbit, it'll increase the frequency of the orbit. Sort of the leading order effect here. Is that you get what's called a chirp. That's a uptick in the frequency as a function of time. That's the orbital frequency, and then the gravitational wave frequency is just twice the orbital frequency. I've written this the script M, which is called the chirp mass. And the briefest power of the symmetric mass ratio times the total mass. And you can see that the reason this is called a chirp mass is it basically tells you how fast, as a function of frequency, the frequency is changing. I don't know if you've ever seen these like spectrograms of the gravitational waves. So you divide your signal into bins of time, and then in each time you do a Fourier decomposition. So you have power in frequency as a function of time, then the gravitational wave signal sort of looks like this. It's kind of noisy, but you have basically power here, right? Sort of the bending of this is leading order just set by the chirp mass. So that's actually this number is the number that is most accurately measured by the gravitational wave signal. You might not have a good idea of what the individual masses are, but this particular combination of the masses is very well measured. Yeah. So for the post-Newtonian, this is, we should note, this is just an asymptotic series in V over C. So there's no guarantee that, you know, at some finite separation where you have finite velocity that, you know, going to higher and higher orders will actually help you. But so far, we don't seem to be there yet. And people, the sort of current state of the art is finish up the five post-Newtonian order calculations, which you know, become very, very intense. Yeah, so that takes us to the merger. And you know, here you sort of need to solve the full solutions. And that's usually done numerically. You know, in principle, you should be able to just numerically solve the field equations kind of in any regime, and that should give you the right answer. But in practice, you know, during the n-spiral, you have wide separations and you have very long time scales. So that's difficult to sort of do numerically. Another regime where it's difficult to do that is if you have extreme mass ratios, for example. You know, like, for example, supermassive black holes that have stellar mass objects that are inspiring or are falling into them. So there, again, people typically try to use black hole perturbation theory to tackle those. But for numerically solving the fold equations, just to mention kind of some of the issues that people had to tackle to get this work. So one is, I think we basically touched on all these already in class. One is having a well-posed formulation of the Einstein equations. So we mentioned several examples. We went to the generalized harmonic one, and then tutorially went through the BSSN equations. Briefly mentioned how you need to have sort of control over your constraint violating modes. You need to have good initial data that not only, you know, solves the constraint equations initially, but also, you know, as faithfully as possible represents your system that you're physically interested in. You need resolution to be able to resolve the disparate length scales in your problem. You know, in a binary black hole problem, we basically have, you know, we have the size of our compact objects. That's one scale. And then we have the separation of our objects. That's another scale. And then what we really want to do is extract the gravitational waves in the wave zone, right? So that's another larger scale, right? So we have this hierarchy of scales. We want the wave zone, much larger distance than the separation of the objects, which is much larger than the size of the compact objects. And so numerically, it's always difficult to handle these disparate length and time scales. So you know, you sort of need to use various numerical techniques, for example, adaptive mesh refinement. That's a technique where you kind of have more resolution in places that you need it and less resolution in areas of the domain where you need less, where the length scales are larger. And then finally, you need to handle the black hole singularity. So in class, we mentioned one technique to do this is to just use what's called excision. So actually, that's where these apparent horizons come in handy. So in order to know where to excise, you need to know at that time where the black hole horizon is. So an excision, you would search for your apparent horizon at every time, and then some region inside the apparent horizon that you're safe to just excise that and remove that from your domain. There are other techniques where people use what's called puncture techniques. That's a specific gauge that basically shrinks down the singularity to a point, and then you can actually just continue evolving with it. That's another way to handle that. Yeah, and so sort of tackling all these things, kind of a huge challenge, and sort of the first simulations of binary black hole mergers actually didn't happen until 2005. So a long time after the field equations were actually introduced. Yeah, so I think we're about out of time. So maybe that's a good place to just stop here and ask if you have any other questions.
Can you maybe, means apart from this binary mergers and gravitational waves, what all things are there in strong gravity people are thinking about? It's like some kind of probing singularities, or maybe not the signals, but the theory aspects, something. I don't know what else apart from this is happening.
Yeah, yeah. Right, so, I mean, one thing I can mention is, like, with due to singularities is this question of cosmic censorship. So this weak cosmic censorship says that your space-time should always be strongly asymptotically predictable. So if you have places where the field equations blow up, those should be hidden from future null infinity by a horizon. So that's still just a conjecture. So people have considered various ways in which you might see if they kind of stress test that idea. And actually one particularly famous example of a way which you actually violate cosmic censorship is called critical phenomena. Have you heard of that by Optuik? So the idea there is, you just consider like a one-dimensional family of solutions. So for in Chaptuk's original example, he started with some scalar field profile or something. There's some energy in a scalar field. And then let's say we're going to parameterize these solutions by the amplitude. So if you make this amplitude really small, then the scalar field profile will just might initially collapse, but then it'll just disperse. It won't be strongly gravitating. But then if you make the amplitude high enough, then it'll actually collapse and form a black hole. So then the interesting question to ask is, what happens if you tune this amplitude, the threshold in between where you get no black hole and where you do get a black hole? And what Chaptuk actually found is that so if you sort of tune from above, you get black holes, but they're kind of their masses, go to zero like some power law. And this is just a numerical number that you can get from trying to solve these. And so what this actually means is that, you know, if you look at the you know, the curvature at the horizon of a black hole, and then you allow the black hole to become arbitrarily small, then the curvature will blow up. So in the limit, the so-called critical solution, you actually have a naked singularity with arbitrarily high curvature. That's actually a violation of cosmic censorship. So you know, Stephen Hawking actually had a bet with Kip Thorne and Preskill, and he actually lost the bet due to this critical phenomena. And I mean, in some sense, it's kind of an artificial example because it's a sort of measure zero solution, right? You have to have something exactly tuned. That's one maybe example of you know, not compact object mergers. Yeah, another thing is like people have been interested in understanding black hole solutions in higher dimensions. And so in that case, you know, you don't just have black hole solutions, you can have black strings, what are called black Saturns. That's like a circle with a force around it, and all these kinds of solutions. Actually, most of them turn out to be unstable. And like another kind of open question for a long time is, if you take one of these black strings in higher dimensions that's unstable, what happens? And it turns out it actually, basically what happens is you have this black string, and then it wants to pinch down into some solution like this. And then these parts, again, will undergo some instability. And then, you know, those will pinch down again, and you'll get like, you know, smaller and smaller ones. And actually, in this case, this cascade keeps happening until you actually kind of pinch down all the way, and then you can get a naked singularity. So it seems this cosmic censorship is kind of maybe special to, you know, four-dimensional space-time. And once you go to higher dimensions, you actually can violate it still. This actually seems pretty special. Yeah, well, I'll let y'all go, but if you have any questions, I'll stick around for a few minutes.